Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Talking Tudors, episode 69. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast and welcome patrons who joined the Talking Tudors family in March. A warm welcome to Madeline, Yvette, Karen, and A. Wilcox. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. April's prize is a copy of Cor Rotto, a novel of Catherine Carey by Adrian Dillard. A huge thank you to Adrian for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about the Grey family is Melita Thomas. Melita is the co-founder and editor of Tudor Times, a repository of information about Tudors and Stuarts in the period 1485 to 1625. Melita has loved history since being mesmerised by the BBC productions of The Six Wives of Henry VIII and Elizabeth R when she was a little girl. After that, she read everything she could get her hands on about this most fascinating of dynasties. Captivated by the story of the Lady Mary galloping to Framlingham to set up her standard and fight for her rights, Melita began her first book about the Queen when she was 9. The manuscript is probably still in the attic. While still pursuing a career in business, Melita took a course on writing biography, which led her and her business partner to the idea for Tudor Times and gave her the inspiration for writing The King's Pearl, Henry VIII and his daughter Mary. The research for this book led her to want to know more about the Tudors' cousins, the Greys, who were prominent members of the court. The result was her second book, House of Grey. My conversation with Melita straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Tudors, Melita, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear. Now, since our last chat in 2019, we've had lots of new listeners find the podcast. So would you mind introducing yourself again and telling our listeners a little bit about your background?
Oh, hello, everybody. I'm Melita Thomas. I'm the editor and director of Tudor Times, which is an online repository for all things Tudor. And I'm also the author of two books. The first one, The King's Pearl, is about Queen Mary I and her relationship with her father, Henry VIII. And the second one, The House of Grey is about the Grey family. Most of you have heard of Lady Jane Grey. It's not really about her, but about her predecessors and a little bit about why they thought it was a good idea for Jane to be put on the throne.
Fabulous. Now, the last time we spoke, we actually chatted about Mary the First. So if anyone's interested in listening to that episode, which I recommend, that was episode 38. But today we're going to talk about the subject of your latest biography, which you've just mentioned, The Grey Family. So tell us a little bit more about your new book.
Well, I first started thinking about the Grey family while I was researching for Mary, because they just seemed to be everywhere at the court of Henry VIII. They were members of his household. They were members of the household of Catherine of Aragon. They were in Mary's household. They were in Fitzroy's household. And they just seemed to be everywhere. And I thought, well, nobody ever talks about them. I think they were popular with Henry VIII in particular because they were cousins. Thomas Grey, 2nd Marquess of Dorset, was his cousin. But they didn't have royal blood, so there was no challenge from them, but they were close enough to be family and to be supportive. So I think that's probably the origin of their success. So yeah, they were sort of all over the Tudor court, but nobody ever really talks about them until you get to Jane. And I wanted to find out, you know, what the others had all been doing. And the family first came into prominence, I suppose, in the reigns of, I think it was Henry II. And there are huge numbers of Greys, actually. There's numbers of different branches of the family. But the branch I was looking at were Lords Grey of Ruthin, originally, and then a younger son of Lord Grey of Ruthin in the 1430s married a lady called Elizabeth Ferrers of Groby, and she inherited the barony of Groby. And he had the barony of Astley, based in Leicestershire. So this Edward and Elizabeth had a son, Sir John Grey, who married a neighbouring gentleman's daughter, Elizabeth Woodville. And their son, Thomas Grey, subsequently became stepson to Edward IV. So that was really the beginning of their rise from just being, you know, junior members of the peerage to being at the centre of the court.
Okay, so that's a name we definitely recognise, I think, Elizabeth Woodville and her family.
Yes.
So what about during Henry VII's reign? Who were the sort of prominent members of the Grey family at that time?
So that was Thomas, Marquess of Dorset, who was Elizabeth Woodville's son by her first marriage. He had gone into exile with Henry VII, Henry, you know, Earl of Richmond, as he then was, after the failure of Buckingham Rebellion. So he was in Brittany with Henry and then subsequently in France. And it was Thomas Grey who was left behind in France as surety for a loan that Henry took. So people have argued that he left Grey behind, Marquess of Dorset as he still was, that he left him behind because he didn't trust him. But actually, looking a bit more about this loan that he raised, there's no way that a moneylender was going to take any old riffraff as surety. He wanted somebody he was pretty sure that Henry was going to redeem. So I think it suggests that actually Henry prized him quite highly, because he did in fact send the ransom back, the repayment of the loan almost immediately. So once Thomas Grey came back to court, he joined the court. His half-sister Elizabeth of York became Henry VII's queen, and Thomas and his wife, a lady called Cicely Bonville, who was one of the great heiresses of the late 15th century, they were pretty prominent at Henry's court. Thomas took part in various diplomatic ventures. His son was knighted alongside Henry and Elizabeth's son, Henry Duke of York, who later became Henry VIII. And yeah, they were just sort of, you know, quite senior members of the court. He clearly had a good relationship with his sister, Elizabeth of York. And their children were too young really to be taking much part, apart from their oldest son, who confusingly was another Thomas, the 2nd Marquess of Dorset. Yeah.
Goodness, all the Henrys and Thomases, yeah. My head really has trouble keeping up.
Yes, that 2nd Marquess of Dorset didn't get on so well with Henry VII. And in 1507, having previously been on good terms and taken part in the welcoming of Philip of Burgundy, upset Henry in some way, possibly too friendly with Edmund de la Poole, Duke of Earl of Suffolk, and was sent off to the Tower for a bit and then sent to Calais to prison there. But when Henry VIII came to the throne, he was released and came back to court.
You recently gave a talk at Hampton Court Palace, which centred around three mother and son relationships in the Grey family. I thought it would be really great if you could tell us about one of those relationships.
Yes, well, the first one was Elizabeth Woodville and Thomas I, and they were clearly very attached to each other, but I think everybody sort of knows about them. So then there was Thomas I's wife, Cicely Bonville, and her son, Thomas II, and then there was Henry, later Duke of Suffolk, and his mother, Margaret Wotton. So I'll talk a bit more about Thomas II and Cicely Bonville. As I mentioned before, Cicely was a great heiress. So, I mean, she'd been chosen probably as a wife for Thomas I because she had lots of money, which meant that his stepfather, Edward IV, gave him a title, but no land. So that was a good way of dealing with him without having to give him any money of his own. And when Thomas I died, he left Cicely as his executor, and he left a whole load of bequests in his will, that his daughters should have dowries, that quite a lot of money was to be spent on the family mausoleum. And in fact, Thomas himself didn't really have much money. So Cicely had the job of paying out all of these bequests without there being much money to do so. And her son, Thomas, felt very aggrieved by the whole process. He felt he wasn't getting his fair share. And he became even more aggrieved when Cicely remarried. She picked as her husband a man who was some 20 years younger than her, in fact, younger than Thomas II himself. So we have an early instance of a cougar and a toy boy, I think.
Yeah, right.
Cicely was, she was well into her 40s, and she certainly didn't need any more children because she already had 14 of them.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, she and Thomas I were lucky. They had 13 children who survived infancy, so they did pretty well. And so far as one can tell, although records for people who aren't actually members of the royal family are a bit thin, she didn't seem to have much trouble with miscarriages or infant deaths, which is a happy situation for her. But I can't imagine that when she married a second time she was hoping for more children. Anyway, she married this second husband, who was the younger brother of the Duke of Buckingham, and Thomas II was extremely unhappy about it. In fact, he and Cicely quarrelled so badly that Henry VII got involved, and his council called them both up in front of the council to set them to set aside their differences and their difficulties. And the council came up with a scheme which was quite harsh on Cicely, in fact, because it limited what she could do with her own property. But, that's how things went in those days. Even women who inherited property tended not to have quite as much freedom to deal with it as a man would have done. So, the matter was smoothed over, but they never really were reconciled. And quarrels about money continued for the next 20 years. And it looks as though Cicely's husband did certainly limit how much she helped her children by her first marriage out of her own pocket, although they spent quite a bit of money on building. And then later, after actually Cicely's second husband died long before her, in fact, in the early 1520s, he died young. And after that, there were a number of agreements that were brokered by Cardinal Wolsey to try to resolve the arguments about money. But they didn't really reconcile. And in her will, Cicely wrote three different clauses saying that if Thomas tried to interfere with her will in any way, in which she had decided effectively to pay Thomas I's bequests, he was to be barred from inheriting as much as her executors could possibly do. So she clearly didn't trust that he was going to accept her bequests to her younger children. I think she was a bit harsh on him, actually, or else he realised after he'd seen the will that maybe he'd gone too far, because in fact he was pretty generous to his younger siblings and does seem to have made every effort to fulfil Cicely's will. So it's a bit of a pity they weren't reconciled. And then in the next generation, Margaret and Henry had even more quarrels about money, because Thomas II didn't long survive his mother, only by about a year. So there were all of his father's bequests, all of Cicely's bequests, and all his own bequests. And by that time, not much money was left. So Margaret Wotton, who'd been Thomas II's wife, she had a number of children, all underage, to bring up. And because he was underage, then the wardship of her son wasn't necessarily held by her. And she and Henry quarrelled extensively about money for the rest of her life, really, and never seemed to have been reconciled either. So yeah, lots of family quarrels about money.
Yeah, sounds like quite a messy situation, doesn't it?
Yeah, and yet they all seem to have been very fond of their siblings. All the siblings in both generations seem to have been very close.
I really enjoy hearing about the sort of lesser known characters. So that was great to hear about that tumultuous mother and son relationship. But I'd love to hear about some other lesser known members of the Grey family. Are there any others that you can tell us about?
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting ones. I mean, Thomas I and Cecily had, as I say, you know, a quiver full of children. And amongst them was Elizabeth, Lady Elizabeth Grey. And she was probably one of their younger daughters. And she was in the train of Mary the French Queen when she went to France. And in fact, her brother Thomas II was one of the leaders of the diplomatic corps that went with Mary the French Queen. So Elizabeth Grey served in France. And then when she came back to England, she seems to have been variously with Mary or with Queen Catherine. Later on, she married without her mother's consent, which of course, again, made all sorts of financial difficulties. But she married Gerald Fitzgerald, the Earl of Kildare, and went off to live in Ireland and became sort of quite embroiled in Irish politics. And there's a letter from her to Wolsey trying to get Wolsey's support for her husband, because the Fitzgeralds, they were in constant feud with some of the other earls. I think the Desmonds, it was off the top of my head. So Elizabeth Fitzgerald got involved in that discussion. Later, her husband was sent to the Tower, and he died in the Tower. He wasn't actually executed, but he died. And she was given a pension by Henry VIII and stayed on the fringes of the English court. Her daughter, another Elizabeth, but she was the Fair Geraldine, who the Earl of Surrey wrote a sonnet to. I mean, she was only a little girl, but that was Fair Geraldine. She was Elizabeth Grey's daughter. Then another quite interesting one is Lord Leonard Grey. And I have to say, I had never heard of Lord Leonard Grey before I started researching for this book. But he was the younger brother of Thomas II and had a very good relationship with his brother. And he was a member of Henry VIII's court. He was one of his spears, and he actually courted Bessie Blount after she was first widowed. So he was on very good terms with Cromwell. He and Cromwell appeared because Cromwell started his career in the Grey household, which is another interesting link. Wolsey started his career in the Grey household, and then followed by Cromwell, who then moved into Wolsey's household. So you can see all these networks.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's all networks, all about that. But anyway, Lord Leonard and Cromwell were on good terms. And so there's these letters from Leonard writing to Cromwell saying, oh, you know, can you put a good word in for me with Lady Tollboys, as she was then, and also with the king, because obviously he thought the king might be concerned as to who was to marry the mother of his illegitimate son. Now, from Henry's point of view, it probably would have been quite good, because he would have trusted Leonard as his cousin with no royal pretensions. But anyway, it doesn't appear that Elizabeth Tallboys was at all interested in him. Well, she married Lord Clinton, who later, as his third wife, second or third wife, married Fair Geraldine, Leonard's niece.
Oh, my goodness.
you just have to keep all the family trees in front of you, because it gets such a tangle. But a little snippet of information about Lord Leonard. He had pet deer, and there's the Grey family were quarrelling with the Hastings family in Leicestershire. And in some sort of mafia-style revenge attack, a chap called Sir John Villiers, who was part of the Hastings affinity, had Leonard's pet deer, who had bells around their necks, had them killed and their heads set on stakes by the front door.
Oh, my goodness, that's awful.
Terrible, isn't it? Yeah, and then Leonard went off to Ireland, possibly because it was thought that as the brother-in-law of the Earl of Kildare, he would have influence there. And he became Lord Deputy of Ireland, which I hadn't known before. And he started off being quite successful, but then he got entangled. You know, there were always politics going on in Ireland, but he was seen as Cromwell's appointee. So when Cromwell fell, Leonard was accused of helping Elizabeth's stepson escape, and he was executed. So,
not a good end for poor Leonard Grey then.
No.
And actually, I feel I could be wrong, because this is completely off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure I have read an account that when he was on his way to Ireland, Anne Boleyn took a jewel that she had wrapped around her waist, I believe, and handed it to him as a sort of parting gift. And I'm almost positive that was Lord Leonard Grey.
You're absolutely right. It's mentioned in the Lyell letters.
Possibly
because, as I say, he was rather, he wasn't even a protege of Cromwell, because he was almost the other way around, but because he was part of that reform forming circle, and it would appear that the younger generation of Greys, or certainly Leonard, was lent towards reform, and obviously in the next generation. Although his sister Elizabeth, with whom he does appear to have had quite a close relationship, she was a strong supporter of Catherine. So, I mean, the Greys were split just like every other family over the annulment. But Thomas, the second Marquess, Leonard's older brother, in his will in 1530, so fairly early on, left £20 to Anne Boleyn.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So they were, they lent, the men in the family certainly lent towards the reformed position, perhaps not the women so much.
Yeah, yeah. And that tends to be what you find, I think, is a bit of a pattern that.
Yeah.
Okay, so were the Greys during Henry's reign, were the Greys kind of on the, like, in terms of their influence, were they on the fringe of things, or were they quite an influential family?
I think they were influential at a personal level. I mean, Thomas II, Henry was clearly very fond of, and he was given the leadership of Henry's first sort of foreign expedition in 1512, when Thomas took troops to the Franco-Spanish border in support of Henry's father-in-law, Ferdinand. Now, Ferdinand played his usual double-crossing tricks, and the English force were not supported as they'd anticipated. And Thomas didn't have the experience. He made a bit of a mull of the whole thing. Henry, contrary to what you might suppose, Henry actually was pretty, I'm not sure the tolerant word is quite right, but you know, if people did their best and were honest and told him what was going on, he forgave mistakes or things going wrong if he thought that people had done their best and been honest with him. Where he got really upset was when he thought people were hiding things from him. Presumably that was his paranoia kicking in. But, you know, he understood later, you know, and he said, well, you know, I understand the fortunes of war. And so Thomas did make a complete mull of it. Ferdinand blamed him very heavily, although Ferdinand had, you know, basically wasn't supplying the troops and the food that he'd said he would. And Thomas got a public dressing down, but Henry clearly didn't hold it against him. Because, as I say, he was then sent in 1514 with Mary, the French queen, to France and acquitted himself very well. He was a famous jouster. So he was a member of Henry's council, but he was never as influential as some of the others. But he was very much sort of a trusted second tier, I would say. He got involved in the Scottish Wars. He was always in the commissions of peace for the county. And he was generally close to Henry until he died in 1530. But then his son, Henry, who was later the Duke of Suffolk, the king had very little opinion of. I mean, he got ceremonial roles, but he never got a decent job under Henry. And he was passed over for the Order of the Garter numerous times. So, and the other brothers, as I say, Lord Leonard was Lieutenant of Ireland. So sort of second tier, but Thomas was close to Henry.
Yeah, it sounds like there are lots of connections there, definitely. Mm-hmm. Now, we've touched on the family's sort of division around the topic of Henry's annulment to the marriage of Catherine of Aragon. Can you go into that a little bit more and unpack that a little bit more for us?
It's obviously hard to tell what people thought, and you can only you only get traces of these things. But Thomas II had a number of children. There was Henry, who later became Duke of Suffolk, and he was put into the household of young Fitzroy, the Duke of Richmond. But his daughter, Lady Catherine Grey, was in the household of Princess Mary in Wales. So there was sort of a foot in either camp. Elizabeth Grey, there's a letter from Shapweys about where he goes to dinner with Elizabeth Grey and various other people, and Courtney of Exeter. And they're all, complaining about Anne, and they're not happy with her. So it's, they do seem to be in divided. It's Cicely Bomber was dead by then, so there's no idea what she would have thought about it. Margaret Wootton, who was Thomas II's wife, we don't know what she thought about it. There's no sort of evidence one way or the other. The only possible hint is a letter where she writes to Cromwell saying, "The king has asked me to do something. We don't know what it is, and I really don't want to do it. I'd really rather not." And from the timing, it could be about Anne's coronation. But it might not be. And she did, in fact, attend Anne's coronation, and her son, Henry, was made a Knight of the Bath. So whatever their personal thoughts, none of them was going to argue about it at any great length.
Yeah, and I think if Elizabeth's dining with Chapuis and the yes, that they're definitely all enemies of Anne, that those yes, people that you mentioned.
But how, you know, but what they would actually do as opposed to say, you know, that they were unhappy. I mean, you know, yes, it's very often the case that people who've been friends with the first wife aren't that keen on yes, the second. I mean, that's kind yeah, of human nature, really.
What about the Grey family's relationship with the other prominent Tudor families? Like, we all obviously know the Howards. What was their relationship like?
Well, the Howards mixed, actually, because when Henry VIII first came to the throne, Thomas, as Marquess of Dorset, was junior to the Earl of Surrey, but who then later became Duke of Norfolk after the Battle of Flodden. And so he was senior, but he was senior to Surrey's son, Lord Thomas Howard, who later became the third Duke, Anne's uncle. Howard and Dorset were both on this expedition to Spain, you know, that I mentioned before. And there's letters from Howard to Wolsey implying that he doesn't think that Thomas is running the campaign particularly effectively. Now, Howard was a much, much better soldier than poor old Thomas ever got to be. So there's a bit of tension there. Also, during the trip to France with Mary to become Queen of France, there does seem to be a bit of rivalry between the Howards and Charles Brandon and Thomas Grey, who were clearly very close friends. But Thomas later served with Howard, who was by then Earl of Surrey, in the north, and Surrey wrote very complimentary letters about him. And when Thomas died in 1530, he left a bequest to Howard. So I think, you know, I think they got on all right. They were fellow councillors to Henry, and, you know, I think they had their ups and downs, but, you know, you do have ups and downs with people you work with. So I don't think there's any enmity there. But his closest friend was Charles Brandon. Okay. They were sort of a similar age, and they were both very talented jousters. So the two of them represented England at the jousts for Mary's marriage, you know, along with a team of others. But they were two of the most successful jousters. And Brandon later took the guardianship of Thomas's son, and he also tried to help out with various financial matters. So, yeah, that was his closest friendship. Because of the sort of generational difference, there's nothing really that Thomas had to do with the Seymours. Later, Henry Grey was, as always, completely politically inept, and he backed Thomas Seymour against his brother Edward, which was
oh dear,
not the right choice. And then Henry Grey was later very friendly with William Parr. Again, he was, you know, a strong reformer, so he moved yep, in reformist circles in the 1540s.
Now, I'm sure that our listeners are quite familiar with Lady Jane Grey. I was wondering if during your research, your views about her changed at all, or did you learn anything that you were kind of surprised about her life?
Yes. I'd never really bought into the kind of Victorian idea of Jane as an innocent child, because you have to remember that in the 16th century, you know, 16 is not a child. I mean, it's, you know, they had a different view from the Victorian view of it. But what I really found about Jane is her utter single-mindedness and her complete devotion to her Protestant faith, which she shared with her father. She and her father had a much better relationship than is generally suggested. I don't think that there's any real evidence that Henry and Francis bullied her or that she was unhappy. You know, I know there's that letter from Ascham, but that was Aylmer? Ascham, whichever one it was, saying yes, it. But, you know, that's a teenage letter, and he wrote it many years after. And if you look at how she reacted, she wanted her father with her when Northumberland went to try and take Mary in. So she was close to her father, harder to tell about her mother. But they absolutely shared their devotion to Protestantism. And, you know, she corresponded as a young woman, as a girl, with Bullinger and other Calvinist divines. So I think she's not so much innocent child. She's Greta Thunberg. Think of a girl like that, and think of somebody, or who was the other marvelous Pakistani girl, Malala.
Yes, Malala. Yeah,
Malala. Think of a girl like that who's got a vision and drive and commitment, and that I think is a better representation of Jane. So
yeah, I think a lot of those Victorian paintings have not really done her justice, have they? She was quite a brilliant mind, and as
she
you
was,
say, just yes, single-minded, yeah, like devotion to what she was doing. So, well, Melita, what's next for you? What's happening in the world of Melita and writing?
Well, I'm just coming to the end of the taught part of my master's. I'm doing a master's in historical research at the University of London, and I'm now start on my dissertation for the master's. Oh. And I'm doing a study of the relationship between the medieval queens of England and the city of London.
Oh, fantastic.
Which I don't think has been done before. So that will occupy me over the summer, but I'm starting my research for my next book as well, which I'm not quite sure when that's going to come out. It was originally sort of set for 21, but it might be perhaps I can get it out for January 22. I need to sort of talk to the publisher about it.
Yes.
Yes. So, and I'm also toying with the idea of going on and doing my doctorate, because I've enjoyed my master's degree so much.
Cool. And do we get a hint of what the new book's about or not yet?
Just at the moment, I'm just going to keep it under wraps. But it's another 16th century.
Okay, good. Well, that's fantastic. That's what we like to hear. Well, yeah. We'll have to keep our eyes and ears peeled for that one. That's fantastic. All right. Well, Melita, you know how we like to end our Talking Tudors episode with a few questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So, are you ready for that?
Yeah. Sure.
Excellent. Now, we love books here, and I think we all love books. So, what was the last book that you bought?
Oh, one for my master's, actually, called From Memory to Written Record, which is an absolutely fascinating book. It's about the development of literacy, 1066 to 1307, and how government became a matter of records. But it's really, really well written. It's not a dry academic tome at all. It's fascinating. And yeah, how reading and writing developed. And even in the 12th century, peasants had their own seals. So, you know, you had this vision that no, nobody could write at all, but actually there was a lot more interaction with the written word than you think. So that was interesting. As far as a novel or something not historically related, it was the latest Tess Gerritsen, I think, because I like a thriller.
And what about a signature dish? Are you known for any recipe in particular?
Oh, well, I've got this one from my mother. I make a mean sherry trifle.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yes, always goes down a treat.
Fabulous. And I know you're extremely busy running tutor times and studying and writing, but do you fit in any other hobbies in there that maybe aren't history related?
I'm still pursuing my walk. I'm attempting to walk around the coast of Britain.
That's right.
So I'm still working away on it, or walking away on it, but it's a bit slow at the moment because I don't have much time. But I'm now in far west of Wales, around St David's. So I'm just inching around the coast.
And I know we've got, you know, there's a few issues with travel at the moment, but if we didn't have those issues, what's a dream travel destination for you?
Well, I'm sort of making a plan with a friend to get to Australia by train.
Oh, okay. I'm wondering how that's going to happen.
Yeah, you have to fly a bit at the end. You have to fly to Bali. Okay. But, you know, basically you can get pretty much to Bali all the way by train.
Wow.
The bus is in there somewhere, but... So we're sort of drafting our plan to maybe go in at 18 months or so, but who knows?
Oh, my goodness, that sounds so wonderful. Well, when you've got your itinerary, I'd love to have a little look just to see where you'll be heading. Now, do you have any pets?
Not at present, although my neighbour is trying to persuade me to take a cat. They have a spare cat, and it's tempting, but probably not just at the moment. But yes, sooner or later, a cat will make an appearance. Right. I'm sure.
Well, you enjoy travelling, don't you? So it's tricky.
Yeah, you've got to be a bit careful with that. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, what's a movie, or maybe a show if there's no movie, that you've watched more than once, you go back to for whatever reason it might be?
My favourite movie that makes me cry every time I watch it, but it's very old-fashioned now, Brief Encounter.
Oh, yes. Do you know, I don't know if I've watched Brief Encounter.
Oh, if you want to cry, watch Brief Encounter, yes.
I'm a big crybaby, I'll probably be falling.
Yeah, if you want to laugh, another got a very old-fashioned one, but Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yes, that one I think I have seen. I'm writing down Brief Encounter so I can look it up.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, can. Yeah.
And so apart from, you know, medieval Tudor, is there any other period of history that you feel drawn to?
Definitely going back rather than forward. So I'm becoming more and more interested in the early medieval period, the 13th century. And although a lot of the master stuff, there's a lot of work on the 18th century, which is quite interesting as well, where you start to see women becoming a more kind of generally involved in public life, I suppose. But no, generally 1600 starts to be a bit late. So it's moving backwards. Yes.
I agree with you. I know. I find the Victorian period quite fascinating as well. And I quite like looking at, you know, the home front during World War II. That's quite a fascinating period too. But I agree with you that once you kind of like the 16th century, then you keep going further back to find out more and, you know, the origins. And where will it end? I don't know. I actually don't know. So, Melita, do you have any writing rituals?
No, not really. The only ritual I have is that whenever I have a spare minute, I just try to do something. So my iPad goes with me everywhere. And if I'm sitting on the train, I'll just quickly type myself an email or something with, you know, notes for an essay or something like that. So, I mean, I prefer to write at my desk because I've got a big screen, but...
And it's good that you do carry your iPad around, because I find that, you know, inspiration strikes at all sort of weird moments throughout the day. And you think, oh, I'll remember that tomorrow. And of course, you don't remember what you thought of.
No.
And so, lucky last, what is something that you'd like to see more of in the world?
Well, I mean, the obvious one, of course, is kindness.
Yes.
Yeah. I find it very upsetting when you see some of the, you know, the unkind things that people write and the media in particular. And it just, you know, every time you write something, you should try to think, well, you know, how would I like that if somebody wrote that about me? And sometimes you think of quite cruel things to say and they're funny, but they're not really, are they?
Yeah, so, I agree with you. Kindness, so important. Absolutely so important. And the very last thing, of course, is our Tudor takeaway. So I ask all my guests to suggest something for our listeners to have a look at or listen or watch after the episode. So do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I've actually got two. One of them is a thing called Layers of London, which is a mapping thing that's actually being done by the Institute of Historical Research, where I'm studying, so I know about it. But it's they've mapped London over time. So you can look at London in the Roman period or the Tudor period or the medieval period, and it just sort of builds up. So that's Layers of London, and that's fascinating for people who are interested in maps, which I definitely am. And the other one is a thing called Sexy Code Ecology.
Oh. That's one I haven't heard before.
Yeah, it's all about illuminated manuscripts. So a little bit earlier than Tudor, but there's some fascinating stuff about manuscripts and digitized manuscripts. One of the things I'm studying, because I have such trouble with the handwriting, is paleography. So yes. I'm spending quite a lot of time with manuscripts at the moment. But yeah, Sexy Code Ecology.
I love that. And there, but so if we Google that, we'll find those websites.
Yes. Yeah.
Fabulous. And I'll do that and add links to our show notes for everyone. Well, Melita, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you again. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about your new projects. And I wish you much luck with all your studies.
Thank you very much. And thank you everyone for listening.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.